So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke. Don't do
if I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Stocks. Jocks.
Starks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now.
Yo.
Blowing up by Stacks and Jacks. I'm somehow Jim Lawler on the board. SP Futures up 11. NASDAQ Futures up 168. We have a professor, Mr. John Lee. I don't know if he's a professor much, but do we have him?
Well, you can call me anything you want to.
Yeah. Just not late for dinner or what?
Yeah. I haven't been late for dinner for years.
So, what's up? So did you see the guy from the Cardinals? Jim, did you read any of his background?
Wait a minute. Before you go, I picked up the greatest newspaper in the world, which is what they used to call the Chicago Tribune on Sunday. Front page articles. This is the greatest newspaper in the world. Salvation with a twang. Illinois Cowboy Church blends worship, Western themes, and equestrian culture. That's 2.5 pages in the first section. Failure to close funeral home is another one. And then pesticides, you know, drift into state parks. That is the front page of the greatest newspaper in the world.
Well,
Cowboy Church and the funeral home.
They keep home with 100 people. Firing anybody who does anything, any writers. They have no real reporters. And, you know, I'm going to have to, funny you should lead me down this road, John. When we first started the show, I have to call up Matt Weber and ask him. We had a guest 2-3 times. This is, God, this has to be 10-12 years ago. And he was a guy, now, you know, when did they close the city desk? 20 years ago?
Oh, no, they have, you know, once, the Cub family, the family that owns the Cubs, right, years ago, owned the Chicago Tribune.
No.
Who was it? Who owned them?
The Tribune bought the Cubs from the Wrigleys.
Oh, okay. All right.
And then what's his name, who recently died, when he chopped the Tribune up and made it a mess, he got rid of. He's the one who sold the Cubs.
Yeah.
Tell us that guy's name.
One more article here. In Aurora, Falcons fame was years in the making. They just had chicks. Okay. There we go. That's, it's got a lot of heavy-hitting local international news. Sorry, I had to throw that one in there.
Well,
hi, Jimmy. Good morning. How you doing?
He's switching seats because Matt Weber just arrived. Matt Byrne just arrived. Matt Weber. We had this guy who was he came on once, and he's, for those that don't have a clue what I'm talking about, City Desk used to be, when the city had four newspapers, there were people who, if you came out of college, if you wanted to be a reporter, you could go to work for the City Desk. Which means, I think it was just at night. I don't know if they were there during the daytime. They probably were. But any kind of police report, fire, anything like that, the City Desk would send somebody or somebody volunteer to go out and cover the story. Sort of like Jimmy Olsen, you know, on the old Superman shows. And they would write up the story, and all the papers were free to grab it because they all chipped in on these guys' salaries.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Okay. And, by the way, Sam Zell's the guy I was talking about. Thank you for one of the listeners. They disbanded that a while ago. Of course, we were down to like one paper. Now we might even not even have that, but we got maybe one and a half. So this dude who came on, he used to cover murders at night. And the first time he came on, I think he was a stringer. He worked for the Tribune. And the second time he was on, he was actually... We were on at 6, and he was out covering, you know, staring at a body, you know, basically. And And I said, well, you know, something about the Tribune. He goes, no, I don't work for the Tribune anymore. I said, I do all this myself, and I write the article because they don't have anybody out here. They don't. The Times doesn't. You know, he goes, I don't even know if CBS, ABC or CBS does. He goes, I write the story, and I try and sell it to them. So that this has been a 15, 20-year progression.
Oh, it's, you know, for someone who, you know, we don't uncover the nefarious acts of politicians by them admitting it. We uncover them because the newspapers find it.
Used to.
And if you want a, you know, just to segue, if you want to really read the best Chicago journalism, pick up a book by Ben Heck, and I'm probably mispronouncing it. He was here in the 1910s and 20s, and he wrote a book called 101 Afternoons in Chicago. Now, that's when Chicago was a pretty wild and woolly place, to be polite. He then went on to become a screenwriter in Hollywood, and he wrote a couple of very famous movies. But I highly recommend that. I mean, the stories he writes are just, you know, the guy, I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Well, read the complete works of Mike Rickard. His columns are like they're today.
Oh, yeah. It's
John Cass.
Anyways, I just had to throw that
the same way.
That, you know, especially during our conversation with the Japanese yen fiasco that we had this weekend, Tom. It's like, what?
Yeah.
The Cowboy Church in Illinois? Wow. I mean,
there's nothing that we talk about on this show that's ever going to be in one of these papers. They don't think their clientele wants it. If you look at the Channel 9 news at night, and they, you know, these people are not idiots. I mean, they have made a determination that people get their national news elsewhere, whether it's, you know, Fox during the day or whatever the hell it is, or, you know, whatever, CNBC. I hate to even think of that, but they think everybody gets the national news elsewhere, and the Channel 9 at night, and to a large extent, the network news. They're going to focus on stuff that's local, the weather, the sports, the floods, those kinds of things. And I did this weekend. We got some stuff to talk about today on the market, but I did this weekend between the lovely dinner I had Friday night with the John Lee family, and my dinner at my brother's yesterday, and dealing with nephews and nieces and stuff. And I will say that this deal against rich people, you know, and I try and explain, you know, what I would do in terms of tax laws and things to try and reel some stuff in. And younger people, the fact that some of these politicians now are basically running against the rich, the reason why they're doing that is that message is resonating.
Oh God!
It absolutely is resonating, and I really don't like to see it. I think people know that I want to see everybody taxed evenly, which would be that's a huge push, because that sure as hell isn't happening. Especially when you got a president who cuts a deal where none of him or his kids can be audited. I mean, the message that people are getting from this, and John has a lovely niece, and I have a really great nephew, and I was sort of getting the same message from both. Look, I don't care. You know more about this than I do in terms of how it happened. I don't care how it happened. When people are making 1,000 times a worker and nobody's paying any dividends, and the person who's getting paid 1,000 times didn't invent the drug, he didn't do anything himself, something's wrong, and if the companies aren't going to fix it, we're going to fix it. 90% tax, screw the guy. And it's, I mean, I don't know how he's getting that money because other people aren't, and if that's what's going to happen, you know, if the boards aren't going to do anything about it or anything, you know
the governance that we have is, but you know, look, Tom, I completely agree. I mean, let me just add another nuance.
You know, that's not my view. I'd like to fix how it got there, but that nobody wants to wait for that.
But you know, so you know, for everyone's benefit, I have a niece who's 32 and my son's 28. My niece is a digital marketing, you know, that's her business, and she's built it up from nothing. But, you know, she's, you know, she's my favorite democratic socialist. She's now a democratic socialist. She used to be a populist, but now she's a democratic socialist. And my son works, he works for an AI firm in Northern California. And so, you know, my wife and I, you know, we've been very lucky that we've been around, you know, for 25 years we lived overseas. And so we got to see a lot of things. But my son told me something, and I want to relate this to your listeners. He's doing very well. He's 28. He works like a dog. 12 hours a day. He's well thought of. But you know what? That is not easy. He said, I do know, and I actually know Tom Bongiorno's grandson. He got an engineering degree from Virginia Tech. And, you know, and he was having a problem getting a job.
Yeah.
And when did an engineering degree have a problem getting a job, Tom?
And you know, like your son, he said, there's no way in hell he can, he's moving to San Francisco, there's no way in hell he can afford rent in San Francisco.
No, I mean, but, you know, Tristan told me, he goes, no, if you get on the wrong side, I mean, it happened to me, it was my fault. You know, I was not a cloud or a cyber guy. This is 4 years ago. So my IT career, you know, kind of went off the rails and, you know, and 2 years ago I retired. But it's not easy for these people.
No.
It is really, if you are lucky and you do the right work, yes, you can have a phenomenal career. But the days of just being a normal guy or girl and, you know, getting a college degree and getting a job at more business forums and you work that into something else, those are gone. So now I sound like a democratic socialist. Jesus.
Well, it's not, I mean, I think that when the weird part of it is when you pull the competition out of the mix and,
yeah,
you know, this becomes a problem. I mean, if you're in the board situation, I don't know what you let these companies become a little too powerful. They're not competitive in a lot of cases. They think they are, but they're really not. I mean, so you end up with, okay, what do we do? And plus the SEC is all over. They're the ones that resist tremendously somebody being elected from the outside for the board. Oh, God. So the idea that the chairman picks the board, when the board's, yeah, really, the board's real job is to hire and fire the chairman, that's screwed up. So the idea is, okay, we're gonna offshore 10,000 people. We're going to save $15 million. Okay, fine. We do that. Are we going to pay a dividend? Oh, God, no. Why would we do that? That lowers our bonus. How about we just pay the chairman $5 million? Okay. I guess that, however you got there, you know, when I was at Pullman, which, you know, the last big company I worked for, the chairman made roughly 10 times, 15 times more than somebody. John, without digging into your own business, I'm going to guess you made 17, 18 at Pullman.
Oh, okay. So my first job when Tom, you know, when our one of our mentors, Tom and I's mentor, Tom Fenske hired me. He hired me because I was a good friend of his son. I was making $13,000 a year.
And what were the more senior blue collar guys making?
Oh, they were certainly making $20,000-$25,000.
I think $20,000-$25,000 went overtime. And the chairman, yeah, and the chairman was making $250,000. So 10 times. What is it now? 100, yeah, times? 500 times?
No. And you know, and say we're wrong by a factor of 2. They were making 40 or 50. I mean, some of these, you know, and these welders were pretty highly skilled, highly, yeah, paid guys. And so they could make a, you know, they could make a reasonable, they could make a living. They could make a living. You know, El Sayed, the guy in Michigan, okay, who's running as senator, you know, he made a comment, and, you know, hey, I voted for Ronald Reagan, everybody, so don't, you know, those are my conservative credentials. He said, you know, I am all for capitalism. The problem we have is We don't have capitalism.
No, we
right
don't.
Now.
We don't. That's been my theme for how many years, for God's sake.
Yeah, and I went.
We have some. We have a fascist system. In most areas, we have free market competition in very few spots. We have it in agriculture. We have it in bars. We have it in barbers. We have it in hair salons. We have it in, there are some areas, but restaurants probably even in some areas, food stores. Because you can still open up a food store. I mean, there's got to be, God, we're in Orland Park. Was there 7 or 8 different food stores? I mean, it's a.
Anyways, I hijacked the first part of your call, so I apologize, Tom. Let's go back to what you wanted to talk about.
Well, no, I
had to get it off my chest.
Well, I'm saying this is when you look at the politics and you look at kind of, you know, what's wrong in the health of the economy, and then you have a government that is they're zeroed in on the people who have stocks, okay, and the people who have stocks are and wealth. That they're going to preserve that as best they can, even if they totally screw everybody else. And by the way, to a large extent, you know, I'm riding that train because my clients, I finally recognize that that's what their goal is. I mean, I have for many years now, but for a long time I didn't. And I never thought. I actually thought for a while they might want to have straight government, but now they don't. I mean, we're going to do whatever we can to push money in the system to maintain the wealth bubble, and they're going to do it until way beyond the time that I think they could do it, or certainly the time past when Carl thinks he's going to do it. But that's the mode, that's the motivation, and you know, and maybe someday it'll end, maybe it won't. We see our alliance is changing. The thing that our big Achilles heel is that we're broke. We keep borrowing and borrowing more and more, and pissing off the people that are lending us money. You know, that's an issue. But hey, this guy, I got to talk a little bit. Since Mr. Lawler is here, this guy on
one more.
Welcome back here. We got to talk about this guy who hit the 3 home runs his first day.
Oh, all right, fair enough.
So the kid was, I think he was drafted out of Dominican, Jim.
I believe so.
When he was 18, and now he's 23, and I think he was a, you know, he was a rabbit, a real fast guy, and his time has gone on. He batted like 180 his first year in the minors, and 200 and. He was not any kind of a phenom, and all of a sudden he gets to be, you know, 21, 22. He must have filled out a little bit. That's what happens to people when they grow up. All of a sudden he gets pretty strong. And he had 4 home runs in a game this year in AAA. All of a sudden the guy sees the light, and he fills out like males do when they get in their early 20s, some earlier, some later. And all of a sudden the kid hits a home run, his first pitch in the major leagues, 2 more. So get a load of this. His cleats are on the way to Cooperstown, right? Because nobody in all the history of baseball, this has never happened before. Guy hit 3 home runs on his first day. But the interesting news is they're not his cleats. He had to borrow them. Somebody else on the team, you know, had some Nike, I don't know who the hell was giving him the cleats or sponsoring the cleats. The kid's cleats when he came up with the minor leagues were so lousy he had to borrow them from somebody. So the other guy's cleats are going to Cooperstown with his name on them.
That's fantastic.
Sometimes fantastic. You do get a human interest story out of all this, and
I got to go in 5 minutes because I have got a session here. One last book, which is now, I think Tom and Jimmy, you're gonna, I think I'll like this. Remember Art Buchwald?
Oh yeah.
Okay, so he wrote a wonderful book called what's it called? Oh Jesus, We'll Always Have Paris, and. He was in the Marine Corps.
Well, that line is from Casablanca, correct?
He was in the Marine Corps during the war. And as you said, they did not appreciate my sense of humor. So then he went to work as a correspondent for the International Herald Tribune, okay, which was owned at that time by the Chicago Tribune. And it's basically, you know, his adventures, you know, in Paris as a new father. And he had like 7 kids. No, he had 5 or 6 kids. He adopted every single one from an orphanage in Spain. But now, those stories that he tells in that book are just fantastic. That's another book for your listeners. We'll Always Have Paris by Art Buchwald. Now, that is, I know I'm kind of.
Well, that's the.
How old I am.
Did he steal that line from Casablanca? He must have.
I'm sure he did. You know, as he would, readily admit. Anyways, go ahead.
Well, the one in there too. So we have, you know, kind of another. We had the allegedly tame CPI report. Like I said, I was on with Joel's people, and we were talking. Well, I was on with Joel. Was talking to his people on his podcast, and he, you know, I was saying that the problem with the price level right now is not well, if it gets worse from here, that makes it worse. Duh. But we're talking 3.4% year over year. I'm going to say it's higher, but that would be me. And it, whatever it is, it's above the wage growth. So if it gets worse from here, that's not good. But the big thing that's right up everybody's behind is the massive gap from COVID that we absolutely refuse to deal with. And, oh, by the way, if we have any more problems, we're going to continue to pour more money in. And we're gonna pump up, and this is so German, it's scary. It's what the Weimar Republic did, and I, you know, and that ended very badly. And now we have this debt number, and the people that I talked to this weekend, it should be obvious to all. And again, I hate to have me say this, it has to be obvious to all, Mr. Lawler, that we need more revenue at the federal level. You know, President Tariff is going to continue to think that he can close this gap somehow by imposing all these tariffs and telling his MAGA people that somehow somebody else is paying that tariff. I don't know how long he gets away. I think that message, even his people are sitting there going, wait a minute, I'm paying this, they aren't. I mean, it's, you have to be a really rabid MAGA to think that somehow you're not paying the tariff freight, especially now that when the rebates came, and it came to people that charged you, and oh, by the way, you didn't get any money back. Which,
yeah,
and now
Apple was the largest recipient of tariff refunds.
Well, but so Nike did well. Walmart was right up there with Apple, weren't they?
So was Target. I just looked at Apple, and it was huge.
I thought Walmart was 65. Was it in the billions? It was a big number. So, but Nike was right there. There are a lot of them there, but I thought. If I was going to name the top six or seven, I would say Apple, Nike, Walmart, Target, and I don't know who else. Who after that? But there's all kinds of people in there, and none of that's coming through. What was Walmart say? We're going to get it back to you by continuing to charge as low as we can, or some ridiculous comment like that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Of course, how would you get it back to everybody?
I got to get going here,
right.
But...
do we have Mr. Flanagan?
Good morning.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good, Tom. Hi, John.
Hey, John. I'm going to forward to everybody, and please forward on to Mr. Flanagan, too. Shouldn't we say Esquire?
Yeah, well,
after
something.
That, John?
I don't know if he's an Esquire.
I can think of better words. But
yeah.
Okay. About the bio. Remember we were talking last week about biolabs and gain of function research?
Yep.
There's an excellent article in the New York Times about the regulation, lack of it, and the number of bio labs. And there was just an article written in Cell Magazine, obviously it's a scientific journal, about they were doing gain-of-function research in China. And the problem is, they're doing gain-of-function research everywhere, around the world. So now... There's 54 labs that have got the on a global basis that have this the top level of biosecurity. I'm going to forward the article to everybody, and maybe I'll come back on later on this week and we can talk about it. But anyways, I got to get going right here, guys.
Have a good one.
Okay.
Talk to you later.
Care,
all right. Talk to you later. Bye.
I got a thing that Mr. Flanagan would be good at. I actually texted Audrey last night. Later, I go, if you're up, I got to call you. I got to give Nancy no end of grief when she comes on too today about, because when Nancy comes on, we're going to talk about. Plus, we have Mr. Jim Lawler, who knows a lot about this stuff. We're going to talk about a little bit about the floods in Indiana and here, and the flood insurance and who gets it and who can't get it and all that kind of stuff. But a few years ago, before COVID, Audrey, who's like, to a certain extent, a combination of Wrangler Jane and Ellie Mae with her critters, right, drags me out to this alpaca farm. I don't know if you guys know anything about alpacas, but I guess, you know, is it even wool? It's not wool. Whatever it is, it's really, if you ever had anything alpaca, it's pretty, I mean, it's nicer than wool, whatever. But so we go out to this alpaca farm, and the place is pretty cool. And you learn a lot about, you know, alpacas and herding, things like that. And last night on Channel 9 News, it had to be the same place. They're talking about this alpaca farm, and they've got these ladies now that on Sunday morning go out and put their yoga mats down in the middle of the pasture with all the alpacas and do their yogas out there where it's nice and peaceful. And I'm thinking, Nancy and Audrey should grab Flanagan. I don't know if Mr. Lawler's ready for this, and go out and do this. I would laugh my behind off. But the weird part is, the adult alpacas are like, well, they're all females in the one area. They keep the two males off in one spot, doing what males do, fighting, run around all day. But the adults kind of totally ignore them. The little ones, the babies, are walking around right in the middle of the yoga class, and they're like looking at them like, hey, what are you people doing out here? it was the funniest thing I've seen in forever. I could see you doing that, Jen. You and Nancy and Audrey out there. I don't know.
As long as you bring along some big stick so I can get up after I'm down on my yoga mat.
Oh, after a couple of weeks of yoga, you'll be springing up like you're 25.
I doubt it.
It was so funny. The little ones are walking around, like looking at him, going, "Hey, what are you guys doing?" The older ones totally ignored him. I think it had to be peaceful and serene, but it probably smelled a little bit. I don't know. But well,
are they like llamas, or are they related?
They're actually, I'll take 30 seconds. It's pretty. They're sort of like llamas, but you can't have a shepherd or a collie because they refuse to be herded. They don't want to be herded, so you have to get them like a Great Pyrenees or something, like a flock guard, because they are very susceptible to like coyotes and foxes, especially the babies. Or, and this I didn't realize until I was out there, you can get a couple of llamas, because llamas are very protective. No coyote or fox wants to mess with a male llama. They're pretty tough boys. And you can have a couple of llamas in there, and the male llama, he'll protect the alpaca.
Really?
And so you need a Great Pyrenees, and if you want, you get a male llama if you want to deal with him, because they're pretty rude hombres. The male alpacas, they were in another pasture. They're just running around being males, banging at you, while they're running around, you know, doing goofy stuff, and you let them in once in a while for the obvious purpose. But no, they're very peaceful animals, and they don't want to be messed with, but they're not gonna, especially the females. They can't deal with a coyote, or a few of them, but a Great Pyrenees can. And the Great Pyrenees don't mess with him. He just becomes their buddy and chases away the coyotes. That was so interesting. I would never have guessed that. Hey, don't you guys have a shepherd? Oh, no, they can't do a shepherd. They don't want to be herded. How weird is that?
I think I saw, they used to have a petting zoo that used to come to Evergreen Plaza periodically. They had it set up in the concourse there. I think there was an alpaca there one time. I haven't been close to too many alpacas, but interested in them.
They're cute little things. They're very inoffensive. Yeah. Anyway, the news of the weekend, other than the sports, what about all these floods? We're going to talk more when Nancy comes on. This is really something. It's this Indiana thing, and I actually was digging around the White River. There's two forks, and it comes together, and we're Columbus, and then it heads to the Wabash River. I mean, this flood's going to make it to the Wabash River, and I guess it's going to cause some floods in the Ohio River.
It would, yeah. I mean, it's this summer. I mean, Chicago got a little bit of a taste of it. We got more rain in the last 3 or 4 weeks than we're used to. But man, out east of here, it's something else. God.
Well, even down by Orland, Audrey had another branch land on a piece of fence, and this is a guy comes out to. She's become friends with, I think these guys actually work for one of the townships out there doing tree stuff. But they're free to, you know, go on their own on the weekends and stuff. So the guy, he's a nice guy, Hispanic, comes out and he comes out right away and he starts cutting this branch that landed on Audrey's fence. And you know what? Every one of these guys that come out, not every one, but just about all of them, their sons are all with them. The kid's never at home on the sofa hacking around on his cell phone. He's helping dad out. Hoping it's a relationship like we remember when we grew up. And the families are very tight, and the kids are not. If the parents are working, the kids are working. It's really a nice thing to see, I think. But I says, so I'm talking to the guy. I go, do you got enough business? He goes, I got so much business. And he goes, and if I didn't, I'd head to Indiana. I got all kinds of business down there. But those guys, Jim, you were saying at the game, your guy was, he didn't have power for a week, and now they're talking another, a lot of people back tomorrow, and the rest not till Friday. That's kind of, yes, a ways.
Yeah. I knew people in Hammond, and I knew people in Whiting, and it literally wasn't until almost noon on Saturday did they get their power back.
Well, from the listeners sitting there going, these four guys from Chicago are whining about the fact that it rained, so what? Whatever reason, the last 3 weeks, guys, we've probably had 4 to 5 storms come through here, maybe the last month. Every one of them was not just a thunderstorm. It was preceded by a 60 to 70 to 80 to 90 mile an hour gust of wind, letting you know it was here. I've seen how many more times in my lifetime. Every single storm now is doing that. And the place where Audrey had her, she had a house down there for a while, it's considered part of Portage, but it's really Ogden Dunes, and they had so much wind. Now, this is a very sandy soil, so these trees take forever to grow. They have so many trees knocked down that even the streets are still sort of impassable. And the only good news is one of Audrey's friends said, I think I have a lake view now. So many trees are down. They haven't had power. They're not going to have power for another week. They haven't had power for like 10 days now. And, you know, it's just all of a sudden every there's one guy who was on the news last night. There's a down power line in front of his house, kind of in the street, in the water. So he calls up NIPSCO like 3-4 times, saying, hey, you got a down power line, it's in the water. They never come out. All of a sudden they restore the power, and all of a sudden this thing is sparking away. All the trees next to it are on fire. The fire department has to run out. They never even answer the guy's phone call. They turn the power on without checking to see that they had a down line, for God's sake. I know that something like this causes to have more people than you have, but I don't think NIPSCO was ever considered an A company, were they?
By anybody? No, I would say not.
I would say not. So the weekend we had that, we've got the thing with the aircraft carrier, that's a problem, so we're chasing the aircraft carrier from the Far East, which is the only one we have there, to relieve the Lincoln, which is going to leave us without an aircraft carrier where we always seem to have one around Japan, that area. We have the president coming out and saying he's cutting back on the exercises with South Korea because he's a really good friend of the guy from North Korea. Now, are we really switching alliances from South Korea to the guy with machine guns? Everybody?
No. It's just Trump bluster, and just say something that's kind of like wake everybody up and say, huh? And then try to figure out what he meant by it. That's the whole purpose behind a lot of what Trump does. And it's bluffing in the business world, or positioning, or just finding out just how freaked out your opposition is by something you have in your back pocket that you might pull out but you might not, and just to see what kind of response you get. So
why do people, and I'm not accusing you of this, why do some diehard followers somehow feel that they died and came back to Earth and their job is to interpret what somebody says? Why can't somebody just say what they say and people just believe it? And why is it somebody's job to say, oh, no, that's not what he meant. He really meant this. He's really a good guy. Nobody does that for me. Nobody does that for you. Why?
But people do it all the time, Tom. But
not for me.
it works for people who, practice it and, understand, what they're trying to accomplish. And I'm not saying that I got an inner connection or anything to it, but this is something I used to see happen in real estate deals constantly.
Except this isn't a real estate deal.
But it is, Tom, to him.
Well, okay. I know you're right, John. You're actually right about that. But I mean, when I asked him about
this is what people, in some ways, you know, it's what Trump gets blasted for continually, and never gets enough credit for continually too. That this is something we're not accustomed to having in politics. Period. We don't, you know, we have mayors and governors and senators who never, you know, operated a cash register, you know, let alone started a business or ran a business or made money instead of losing money. So this is a kind of a new phenomenon that people still haven't got their head around, and apparently don't seem to like it very much either, which is kind of just a discouraging thing. But, you know, this is the way a lot of business people succeed. This is how they get advantage. This is how they use their leverage, whatever it is, you know. Well, they make up a situation where this kind of leverage is going to work.
Well, there's this New York style. And I'm willing to go with it a little bit, by the way. I mean, everybody's got a different style. But I don't, when we're having these issues with people on a ship with, you know, 200 days out of port calls, well, I'm glad it's not me. And I think that when people run, I mean, I was privy to, we've had Professor Hal on how many times, talking about when he was at sea and how long he was in the Persian Gulf on the ship that barely ran, I guess. And he never made it to the top. What did he say, Jim? 30 days? He didn't make it out of the bottom where the reactor was? And
something like that.
And he was saying if the water wasn't 90 degrees, he would have jumped in and tried to swim home. Because it got to the point where it was 100 degrees down there, and they had food was getting lousy. And I mean, and he was talking, you know, 30 days. And he told about how long it took to get the thing at, like, how many knots did he say the thing would go? Like 12 or 12, 15? It was coming back, and they were going to decommission it. They came all the way back from the Persian Gulf to Seattle, and how long it took them. But, I mean, the idea of what these people go through, and you know, they said he was walking to the helicopter on Friday, and he says, what do you think about them being at sea 200 days? I don't know if you saw this, John. And he goes, it's not long enough, and took off. Well, there's a guy who's a draft dodger saying that about people that are in the Army or in the Navy. And by the way, his grandfather was a draft dodger, and that's how he got here from Germany. So you can see where there's this somewhat disdain about people who are in there not caring. And I don't know how people say, well, that's okay, or that's the New York style, or it's not okay. I mean, how do you say something? I mean, the stress, because I know that Pullman used to do, and John, you'd love it, because they were Mr. Research Company. You would never guess. They had what do you call them? Something engineering, manufacturing engineering studies, going back to like 1870, to where if you work people 10 hours a day versus 8, how long, how many weeks, they could have it to the day, to where you were getting the same amount in 10 hours than you were in 8. They would do the same thing if you work Saturdays. If, you know, some parts came in and you were behind, you could work 1, 2, 3, 4 Saturdays in a row and get some serious work out of it. But they would say at the end of the 14th week, you'd be down to... So anybody who... And Hal would tell us that when you first started out on the cruise, you had your shifts where you're doing all the stuff you're supposed to do. However, when your shift ended, there was maintenance kind of stuff. You had to go paint this. You had to do that. You had to grease this. You had to do something. There was onboard maintenance because, you know, that kind of stress on a machine, especially in salt water, starts to wear on it. And he goes that the last month that they were out there, all that stuff just kind of, they got so far behind that they didn't even try almost. I mean, you just, between the people being tired and the maintenance stuff was just piling up on them. So to say somebody should, you know, just stay at sea, these people know that the elevators from the hangar deck to the flight deck, after, you know, 1,000 times or 2,000 times, need these kind of parts change or this kind of maintenance or this kind of lubrication. And after 5,000 times, the thing's squeaking, and maybe after 5,500, you don't do something, it's going to stop. So that whenever you have machines, there's an end game to this, right? I mean, it's like your car. I mean, you can run them. If you really take care of it, you're going to get 220,000 miles out of your motor. You're not going to get a million. Maybe if you have one that's, you know, 1 in 100, you might, if you really do all the maintenance, you could do something. But the idea that you can just push, doesn't anybody realize you can't do that, John? You just can't. you, because there is some time when something that complex, you imagine when that thing pulls into port, how much of it they're going to have to totally redo?
Well, you know, I think for a long time, and we haven't had it tested in anything approaching, a war footing kind of scenario like we have just in the past couple months. But I've always been suspicious about the amount of deferred maintenance in not just the Navy, name your branch of service, I think, and the wastage and the crookedness. I mean, this is what happens throughout history when, if you're kind of pulling stuff together and, all of a sudden you really need it and you need it to work right and you haven't been paying attention to it for the last decade. This is kind of America's history in a way.
Well, it's everybody. I mean, look what happened to Russia when they tried to invade Ukraine. They found half the tanks didn't work.
Right. But, I mean, it's just, where was it? I read somewhere that, the thing that broke down was the laundry. I mean, you need a laundry on a ship of that size and complexity, and if you don't have clean clothes, that's or clothes you can bear to be, to live in, there's something really, really wrong all the way through the operation. And it's stuff like this that I think, I'm all for, a strong military and as a deterrent and as a fighting, tool, but I also think that there's a lot of sloppiness from top to bottom, especially when it comes to things like maintenance.
Well, I think Hal said that one of the things, allegedly, who the hell knows, that the fire was in the laundry vent. And Hal said when it happened, again, he's our expert, he was on when they went on aircraft carrier, he goes, that's an example of something that you wouldn't touch at sea. One of the first things you fix when you hit land is a buildup in the laundry vent. And he goes, that's the kind of stuff that can happen if you're out there too long. So I believe what he said that one day. But I think, it's been, Lou and I have talked about this, God, a bunch of times, in terms of we're locked into this, we have this overwhelming technical superiority of just about anybody. Well, I mean, I guess I would say anybody. And we're used to the one-week war or three-day war. And that's what we're set up for. How many times was it? Ken, you were on. It was about, Jim, were you doing the show? Was it a year ago when we talked about, didn't the one fuel ship run aground in the Mediterranean or something? We talked about they only had three or four more. And, for those that don't, I think most people you thought about it for a second, you got a nuclear aircraft carrier, what do you need fuel for? Well, duh, all the airplanes run on fuel, right? And plus I think they have some storage facilities on the aircraft carrier to fuel the destroyers and stuff around them, don't they? So the idea that the carrier strike force doesn't need to be refueled is pretty ignorant, right? Because the planes are running on it and all the other ships are running on it. So we didn't have enough oilers for a long at sea thing in the Mediterranean, and one of them ran aground somewhere. So all this little stuff you think is, you need food, right? You need fuel. All the stuff that the Germans fell apart on in World War II, and one of the major reasons why they lost, we think everything's going to last a week or two. Now, guess what? This one's not lasting a week or two, and we got a problem. Do we have three or four aircraft carriers that we can send out and review and get these guys back after 150 days? The answer appears to be no, right? I mean, we're set up for a certain kind of war, and now guess what? We're in another kind.
I disagree. I mean, we were in Afghanistan for a long time.
That, no naval stuff over there.
No, we were flying sorties. That's generally how they do it, but they were doing it this. But I think it goes back to what John says. The way Trump tries to negotiate is a real estate deal. The problem is he's negotiating on stuff that he doesn't know about. War is not buying a property. And the problem is that people are catching on to it, and he's now kind of looking like the boy that cried wolf. They know he's going to say a bunch of stuff, but he has nothing behind him anymore. I mean, you look at Pakistan, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. They don't trust this. They're creating their own security agreement. People are looking, you know, South Korea is now selling arms because people don't trust us to be the supplier of arms anymore. I mean, his negotiation tactics don't work in certain aspects, and it shows that he's not, you know, he feels that he could bluff his way out of almost anything. And and John's right, in most real estate, that's how it works.
Well, I think it's worked a lot for him in the presidency. It's worked a few times there, too.
It has worked a few times, but internationally, look at it. We don't have a lot of allies anymore because no one believes what he says anymore.
Well, plus we need him to keep investing. John, what did you, I don't know if you were in early enough, what did you think of the discussion about how a lot of these young people just really want to, these people that are running on these platforms of tax the rich, boy, they got some followers.
Well, you got, an unfortunate matchup between what, you know, the colleges are teaching, and so this is to such a degree that you can't escape it. Even if you're in, you know, in an engineering program or something else, you're going to take, you know, basic, a combination of English, history, social sciences, whatever, which have been, I think, completely given over to, you know, the wacky side of academia, and you're not going to emerge unscathed from that kind of exposure. That's what you're going to believe, think, and, you know, it colors your thinking about everything else that you're, you know, encountering in college. And then you couple that to a, you know, a job situation facing you. You know, like we're talking about engineering people who can't get a job. So everything is happening so fast, and there's nobody who can foresee all of the changes. And in some cases, I think are overreacting to the threat of change and making the situation worse, because you've kind of, you know, overinvested in things like AI and, you know, mass replacement of workers to the point that nobody wants to think about ever growing staff again, you know, in any kind of business or industry. And after a long period of offshoring stuff where people never got a crack at these jobs, period, you know, they weren't even on the candidate list. They'd never been hired because the jobs were overseas. All of that has now taken a huge toll, and you've got, you know, people with what we would say is conventional training that should entitle you to a well-paying job, and, you know, it's something that you should be able to, dare I say, retire on.
Fortunately, because I had to sit through it, but fortunately, because it was a learning experience, my time on the board of the CBOE is, it's an interesting dynamic, John, and something that the two younger people I was talking to this weekend, they have no idea about the detail. And actually don't even care. I don't want to know, because I tried to explain some of it. Of course, nobody wants to pay attention, which is fine. But the, isn't what they say, getting old is the, is when you have the answers to questions nobody will ever ask you?
Yeah.
But they don't care why. And maybe they shouldn't. But I was on we hired a new chairman when I was on the SIBO. That's a long story, too, how we got this guy, but whatever. And all of a sudden, the people who come in are the consultants that they're, you know, whatever. What do you call the consultants? How much money? Compensation consultants. And they bring the guy in there and they talk about, you know, this is what other people are getting. And by the way, I mean, Duke Chapman used to have, he would belong to two clubs that they paid for. You know, one, I don't know, was a Chicago club down here, and I don't know if it was a country, a golf course, whatever, but he had two clubs. So they come in and they go, now all these guys at this level get three clubs. I'm sitting there going, okay. And we, you know, you got to give this kind of thing, this kind of retirement, this kind of other thing. But the dynamic of it was, these boards, a lot of them are composed of other CEOs or high-ranking people at other companies. So they're not dumb people. Once you give this guy a raise and say that he deserves three clubs instead of two, a year from now, what you do at your firm is you have your people hire one of these firms to come in and review what you get. And now they're going to come into your place and say, gee, everybody's supposed to have three clubs. This guy's only got two. It becomes this, every time a board gives somebody a raise, they essentially have given themselves a raise, or at least some of the people on there have. So you get this piggy moved off to the point where you're so far away, or can be so far away, it's nowhere near. You know, I'll give you two examples. PTI Securities and the Tripoli Tap. Now, what do they have in common? Well, I guess my brother could give himself a $2 million bonus. You know, I don't know what that would do to the rest of the place. And I guess Nick at the Tripoli Tap could give himself a $1 million bonus. A, the check had bounced, and B, what does that do to everybody else? But I don't know which is worse, the fact that some of these people are getting this kind of money without really... And I'm not saying a chairman shouldn't, but I mean, look at on the not-for-profit area. What do you think that... I mean, I have no idea. I guess we could look it up. What do you think the chairman of Northwestern gets? Northwestern Hospital? I mean, okay. is it 5 million? Is it 8? Is it 10? Is it 20? What if it's 50? What if it's 100? I mean, who makes that decision? I mean, there's no shareholders that can run people against them on the board and say, yeah, that's too much. Where is the discipline? There isn't any. What the young people have figured out is once you get to a certain level, whether you got your nose up the ass of government or whether you control your board or whether you got some monopoly position or whatever it is, there's an awful lot of money there. And instead of sharing it with employees or God help you, pay a dividend, somehow or another, and we're going to have Eric May is going to be on Wednesday, and he's the one who actually has written about this management class. And basically, who the hell do they think they are? They're not doctors. They didn't invent the drug. They didn't make the process. They just kind of landed at the top of some place that somehow has, you know, I won't say they're all monopolies, but some sort of a, you know, governmental contract or some niche or something, or bought out some of their competition. And you know, they actually think they're worth $40 million a year, which is even worse than getting the $40 million, in my opinion. But so, John, talk about this. I mean, you know my opinion on it. What do you think?
Well, you take something like Northwestern, and, you know, I mean, I'm a patient at Northwestern Hospital, and my physician's there. But I would say most of the communications I have with Northwestern are fundraising appeals.
Yeah.
I get the letter from the Northwestern Foundation or whatever. Click off the box whether you want 1,000 or 500.
Yeah, it'd help you if you want to know what your blood test was.
Right. Yeah. That's we're not. This is not part of that mailing.
No.
This number and wait a half hour to talk to somebody. But what these things have become, and I this is why I think whatever this a CEO, if that's what they call them, something like Northwestern makes. It's got all of this stuff that is beyond, you would think, any one person's ability to manage or manage effectively or profitably. But, you know, it's a medical facility. It's got, you know, it's a mega employer of people from top to bottom in terms of skill set. It's got, you know, a teaching faculty for the hospital. It's a real estate empire. It's a philanthropic group. It's a holder of patents. It's, you know, it's participating in advancing, you know, the way to cut costs and testing and all the stuff that is just kind of mind-boggling that anybody is able to juggle that many balls and keep the thing running, keep it running profitably. But every, you know, teaching hospital now is like that. And then you go into other corners of academia, and a lot of this is academically driven, where it's, you know, it's think tanks, it's international governing, you know, bodies that, you know, have consultants and, you know, speakers and you name it, and endowed chairs, and it goes on and on and on, and all of this is just involves tremendous amounts of money, but they've got a cash flow coming in of, you know, foreign governments or, you know, interest groups or, you know, medical technological societies that are throwing money every which way. And this is, you know, this is not like what I would call a business, you know, and it's not something that you would want
to see. But it is a business, a huge business.
Of course it is, but it isn't a classic business. It's beyond this. Well, it's got global implications.
Are you agreeing with me? I'm saying once you become a non-competitive entity, all of a sudden all bets are off.
Well, yeah, I mean, one.
I mean, who are they competing with?
Well, how many hospitals are there in, you know, the Chicago metro area?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Lou was on a few weeks ago, and I very seldom disagree with Lou, but I sure as hell did that day. He's talking about airlines are intensely competing. I go, Lou, there's only four of them. What are you talking about? Well, in their mind, they are, but they're not really, right?
Right.
I mean, back when the...
Well, and it's the same thing in medicine. I mean, you could draw the analogies, you know, over and over again, I think. But what you were saying to John, just the tail end of his, you know, slot today about, you know, there's no competition, just or insufficient competition, which is always, you know, it's kind of like has a cleansing effect. It keeps things efficient. It keeps people on their toes. When there's not much competition, it's pretty easy for things to go totally off the radar, ethically, morally, financially, you name it.
Yeah, but somebody, everybody has to have a boss. For God's sake, you know, as much as, you know, you give the president grief, he's got a boss. It's the people. They can throw him out next time, or not next time, he's got two terms, but they can throw his people out this time. I mean, you know, unless they try and do something, which I hope they don't. But everybody has a boss, and to a certain extent, the governor, the mayor, and the president have all kinds of bosses, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, who is... There's two ways of looking at things. When I was in grad school in the University of Chicago at the time, I think had the only... And somebody, one of the listeners wrote in and said somebody else had one at the time, but the University of Chicago was proud of the fact, you know, they could have been wrong, that they were the only graduate student... graduate program that gave you a master's in hospital management. Now, whether they were the first or not, who knows, but they told everybody they were. So now everybody does. So and I had a course where we talked about a lot of that stuff, and they claim that I'm a cost accountant. If you ask me how much it costs to have somebody overnight in a hospital, I would start adding stuff up from the bottom, but they wouldn't want me. What they did then, and I think they still do now, is they look at all the entire money that the place spends and divides it by the amount of patient nights, and that's your cost. Well, no, it's not. Well, on some level it probably is, but that's not the way I would do it necessarily. And I had one of Robin, he's come on the show. Her brother is a doctor. He's retired. He went to Michael Reese. We're talking about the dear departed Michael Reese. I said, Neil, what if somebody wants a machine or wants something? What happens? He goes, "We got the money, they buy it. If not, they don't." And I go, "Well, does anybody try and figure the return on it? If other hospitals have it, or if anything like that?" And he goes, "No, nobody does anything like that." And the same course I had at the University of Chicago was talking about, this guy had government contracts, of all things, to try and figure out how efficient hospitals were. He's trying to do this mathematically, and this is, you know, this is 1976. And he goes, something about open-heart surgery had just kind of started back then. And he said, out of all the, he named a number of how many hospitals had all the equipment to do open-heart surgery. And like half of them had done none, and another 10 or 15% had done one. And he goes, "You don't want to be the one guy that that they do an open heart surgery for in a hospital in a year." That was before they had the roving teams and stuff. He goes, "It would make so much more sense if you have five hospitals, say on the south side, say a little company, Christ, and a couple, one of them should have all the stuff there is for, you know, kidney problems. One should have all the stuff there is for heart surgery, and they should rotate people around, because no way you need all five of them to have all the stuff other than ego." Well, now what? They're all been bought by one person, right? They're damn near. So, I mean, once you pull the competition out of it in any industry, I mean, look, you pulled it out of it in, I think, in a lot of ways in the military stuff. Now, Lou says a lot of the new stuff, you know, you know, the drones and the technology and the software and stuff is all fairly competitive. Well, the drones isn't, because Trump's kid just bought a drone place, right? And they already got two contracts. Well, that part's not competitive, I don't think. Maybe it is. I doubt if they're giving them the best price, but they could be. I mean, look at what Ukraine's doing against Russia. God's sake, they just bombed Moscow yesterday, didn't they?
Yeah, like a wholesale or a retail facility like an Amazon.
Yeah.
It's completely destroyed.
I mean, these are guys that we gave up for dead. Look at the innovation over there. I mean, it's...
Well, you know, it's kind of, you know, I doubt if this is, you know, something that maybe, I hope they teach it in the military academies, you know, courses on, you know, technology and warfare. I hope somebody's aware of this, and that there's somebody who's, you know, behind an effort to, you know, streamline how wars are fought. Of course, you know what this is going to do, Tom, is make, you know, soldiers, you know, a lot of the staff completely superfluous. Maybe it's a good thing. I don't know. If you can do it all by drones, and, you know, they're fairly cheap compared to a tank or, you know, an aircraft of any size. And, you know, if you know, they're disposable, you know, some of them get through, some of them don't. But you just have to have a couple to get through, and they're hard to track, you know, and, you know, they're easily confused with other stuff. So I just think maybe this is a solution to warfare.
What are you watching, Star Wars?
No, I mean, but I mean, it's the, like, the ultimate deterrent, where you could just have an onslaught of sheep. You know, it doesn't involve personnel at all. You know, it's all trackable, it's all directable. You know, it's not something that you have to have boots on the ground for at all. And if this were a way that,
yeah, you never really, not that I want anybody to, or us or anybody else, I sure as hell don't want to be invaded. But the only way you really take a place over is if your people be in there, right?
Or if you've already, you know, co-opted their hearts and minds, you know, so your task is easier. You've got the advance group to convert these people in their minds to the way things are going to go, and then they're a pushover. It doesn't take an army to make the final onslaught. So.
Well, I would agree.
I was thinking when you're talking about, you know, hospitals and stuff. When I was in high school looking for colleges, and I was just like, remember those Barron's guides? They get these big, thick paperback catalogs that had, you know, colleges up the wazoo listed, and, you know, their enrollment, you know, their biggest fraternities, you know, the programs they were known for, the campus, the cost. But I remember reading about Cornell, and it touted, you know, the particular programs Cornell had, and one of them was, you know, you could get a degree in hotel administration. I thought, well, what the hell kind of a degree is hotel?
Allegedly, the first place to do that. Now, again, there's one of the listeners told me they weren't really the first. When I was in grad school, the only place that was touted to do that was University of Nevada, Las Vegas. They gave you a master's in hotel management.
Yeah, and silly me. You know, of course, when, you know, if this is how we have things like Hyatt, Marriott, you know, all these chains that are global, you know, it's kind of like, you know, Walmart or anything else, and that this can be reduced to, you know, to formulas for profit making, like you were saying, with, you know, how do hospitals decide, you know, how they make money? Well, you know, you take the number of nights in a hospital room of this size, and, you know, they have smaller rooms that maybe command less, and they've got treatments that they don't offer at all, but they, you know, some affiliated hospital has them. All this is, like, crunched.
But it's doable, John. I mean, and I'm surely not the expert on this, but what I'm saying is when you look at, I'll tell you, years and years ago, I had a heart rhythm problem, and I'll tell people, and there wasn't any real fix at the time. You know, still it's a tough problem, but then they decided they had this thing called an ablation, where they'd go in and they didn't have to go through the skin. They went basically up your veins and did some stuff and quieted out the problem, okay? Now, when I first had it done, God, it was 22 years ago. More than that, 23, 24. And I went to Northwestern, and it was an 8-hour procedure. And you were awake, right? So, which is kind of weird, but you were awake for the whole time. You know, you were deadened a little bit, but you were awake. And the bill came, and this is, you know, bill came, it was like $120,000 or some massive number. And of course, it gets discounted for the insurance, and it was, you know, it got down to 70 or 80 or something. And I'm sitting there with my stupid mentality that I have, and I go, okay, let's say 80. There was two or three doctors, you know, one main guy, and let's say they make a $1 million a year. Okay, well, that's, how much is that a day? $5,000? Something like that? That's $5,000 yep. times $2,000. It's $1 million. Okay, so there's one guy making five, two guys making four. All right, we're up to 13. There were three or four nurses. Let's pay them for the whole day as well. And they're making, let's throw another $1,000 apiece at them when I know they're not making $1,000 a day. Well, now we're up to 20. The room, you know, it's some serious equipment in it. Let's give them another $15,000 for 6 hours in the room or 7 hours in the room. All right, we're up to 30. Where does the 125 come from? What's the overhead? 500%? I mean, you know, there's got to be some overhead. I get that part, but what are we talking here? I think the actual cost of them doing it to me that day was probably nowhere near what I'm talking about. I bet it was more like 12 or 15, because it was about a 6-person deal. It's been now, you know, now it's a lot easier, but back in those days, you know, what are we talking about? How do you get from 15 or 20 to 120?
This is something that's always, you know, I've wondered about it. And if you go to, you know, a hospital, you know, for treatment, U of I or you know, name it, there's a crossover, and certainly at Northwestern and any other teaching hospitals, where the people who are their high flyers, the ones who have the, you know, expertise, who have the years of practice, and, you know, whatever pioneering surgery they pushed and got, you know, people coming in the door for. They're also faculty in their medical schools, and they are salaried as, you know, faculty, tenured, huge salaries, huge pensions too. The highest pensions by far in the state university retirement system that I'm in as a community college alum are the people at, you know, the medical schools, you know, attached to Illinois universities. So if there's a surgery that these people perform, you know, they have a teaching schedule, they've got mentors, they've got, you know, assistants, all this stuff. But if they do anything on the retail side of practicing medicine, I've got to believe there's some kind of way that they're, you know, relief from their teaching duties, you know, because now they can't teach if they're doing.
Well, they all sort of teach. I mean, Dr. J's dad was a chief surgeon in Minnesota, but he also, remember, he did a surgery. There were probably 5-6 people in there that he was lecturing to sort of when he was doing the surgery. It's all
part. Oh, right. And that's crossover too. Yeah. That's what that's why the bill, I think, ends up being what it is because this is not just.
But those
actual
kids, those people are paying. The kids that are listening, they're paying.
Yeah, of course. But they can justify it just from, I guess, from a bookkeeping standpoint. That, you know, it's not just the work that was done on patient so-and-so and the power that was used for these machines. They know exactly what all this stuff is costing just from a delivery standpoint. But then you've also figure in the fact that these people are so valuable to the institution that, you know, we're going to give them a premium for taking time out from their classroom work or their other teaching responsibilities besides just the surgery.
But Dan, the waste is what I would consider overhead. I won't say waste. I want to change subject to this, these flood things and stuff. Talk about inefficient. But when Jim and I, one of our buddies, who's one of his best friends, had a heart problem, and anyway, he was over at Northwestern, and, you know, he's doing fine today. So it wasn't like Northwestern did a crummy job. They didn't. But he was in the Shirley Ryan. So Jim and I go over to see him, and we get to the fifth floor. I mean, if you walk on the first floor, Jim, you can pile on this anytime you want. We go to the fifth floor. Jim, how many? There was a desk, elevators, and there were like a couple of couches and like a conference table. We're talking about an entire floor of a high rise that had like 5 people working there. And I'm going, wow. here's some unused space. So we go up to like the 15th floor where it was, and there's this, you know, big workout facility, and he's, you know, he's being taken care of pretty well. But I'm thinking, they could have done this in a building half this size. I mean, Well, why do you need a whole floor for a reception area with five chairs? I mean, the amount of excess is just dramatic. And you look at how many square footage in the place is for patient care. Jim, would you say half? Would you say it was half?
Probably, yeah.
It
was odd. You're right, Chief. I mean, you go in, you give the patient's name, you go up, and then you have to go up to the fifth floor to get elevators to the other floor, and you go through another series of getting signed in. So, yeah, it was kind of odd. When, you go to the hospital, you ask what area. Oh, that's room 1702, so, that's the 17th floor. You go to the elevators, you go up to the 17th floor. Surely Ryan was a little bit different.
But look at the space that was totally unused.
Yeah.
I mean, the outlying facilities that Northwestern has built, and I've gone to the one in Irving Park. I can walk to it from where I live here. I've been there several times for procedures, and it's just what you're saying. It's a beautiful, block-wide building, indoor parking, huge building. See, where the old Sabatino's restaurant.
Really? Was
the old, great, so much food you could barely move when you left. But they knocked that down, put this thing up, and you go inside, and it's like, they're like an airplane hangar, and there's one person sitting at the reception desk, and then you walk another half a block to get to the elevators, and then you get off on that floor, and there's nobody in sight. You walk another half a block, there's a couple people sitting there waiting to check in patients. You go to Northwestern's emergency room, and there's patients sitting in the hallways on top of each other.
Yeah.
But that's by design.
Must be by design.
I think they want to keep all their options open. They're not interested in wasting space, I don't think, but they all are interested in kind of keeping options open for whatever seems to be going, and to get rid of the stuff that isn't making money. And this is why they're constantly shifting whole departments at Northwestern from building A to building F across the street, which is really expensive.
Well, the theme here, in my mind anyway, the theme here is that any place else in the world that's competitive, when you look at like Binny's is this huge wine and booze joint. And they do a nice job. The places are beautiful. They're all, the best racks. I mean, wherever you name it. You go down a block to the Vin, which used to be the wine discount center, and they used to sponsor the show when John and I were on the score. But they don't have any racks, really. They have some. A lot of stuff's just kind of piled up on the ground. And they have, you could get the stuff, really good bottle of wine there for less than $20, a 90 score. But the issue is that people look at like a Northwestern, and other than like the Oklahoma Surgery Center or something, there's nobody that says the mental. Somebody were to say if you've got an appendectomy, we'll do it for $2,000. There are places kind of like that, but very rare, because you're going to turn your nose up and say they can't be as good. You have a lot of people that fly overseas for medical care. Matter of fact, one of our listeners from, I think she's from Atlanta, sent me an email that she was taking care of a lady who unfortunately didn't last very long, cancer, and she was paying for, this lady was paying for the chemo. The lady had no insurance. Well, I sent her a letter saying, boy, you can go to Italy, for God's sake, and it's $5,000, and you're paying 30 here, the same stuff. But before she could get on a plane, she died, unfortunately. But there's no way that somebody can break in on the bottom. It doesn't appear. Now, whether that's designed or whether it's too much money or people just say the hell with it or whatever it is, it's like universities. Somebody should be able to give somebody an MBA for, $1,500 a class, not $7,000, and be every bit as good as somebody else. But you don't get the accreditation. You can't get that. You can't get the reputation. There's a problem with that, John, and we're paying too much. Hey, let's carve our way over to the floods are the big thing in this area, mostly in Indiana, but here too. So yesterday we're gonna have Nancy's gonna pile in a little earlier than she normally does, and John's somewhat aware. And we have Mr. Lawler here, who is an expert on mortgage stuff as well. This flood insurance thing has always been sort of interesting to me, because when you say flood insurance, you got to say, well, what kind of flood? Because in the city, I think Nancy said, and you guys could either agree, that nowhere in the city is a designated flood zone. Now, for those who don't know what a flood zone is, the Army Corps of Engineers comes out and says, okay, guess what? Jim Lawler is going to build a house 15 feet from a river. In the last 100 years, that river has flooded 10 times. So he has to buy, well, he doesn't have to buy it, but if he wants to get a mortgage from Fannie or Freddie or from anybody else, he'd better have flood insurance. Now, you don't get that from, kick me if I'm wrong anywhere, you don't get that from your insurance company, you actually get that from the federal government. It's not the same as the flood insurance rider, like I could put on my place, that if the sewer backs up, it covers the basement. We're talking about floods, you know, water coming in from a river, a creek, or those kinds of things. Or I guess even a hurricane. And the question is, who's forced to be covered? I don't think you can buy flood insurance if you're not in a floodplain, can you, John?
I don't think you can, or you know, they might, you know, make it, you know, burdensome. Or you know, expensive to do it. I don't think they want to be. They'll be happy to take your premiums. Maybe they will, but I
don't think they will. I mean, I don't think like State Farm will do it. I don't.
No, they will.
They will. Regular old flood insurance. If you're not in a flood.
My parents, when they had their house in Santa Barbara, my dad was able through Hartford. Get flood insurance. Don't ask me why, but he had it. He was not on a floodplain. It was not required, but he had it.
Well, that's my point. If he had a say a tree fell over and whacked his roof and it rained into the place and the house quote flooded, I think you can get that kind of flood insurance. But I don't know that he can't go to the government and buy flood insurance from like a river if he's 50 miles from a river.
That I don't know, but I know for a fact that he could get flood insurance. He was not on a floodplain. I mean, he was up on it it's in Santa Barbara. He's up into the hills. So it's not like he's near anything. You know, for the one time that the people that were building in the dry creek beds, and then all of a sudden all the rain hit, they weren't even required because people said, well, you know, these creek beds have been dry for 75 years.
Yeah, it's like 100. Because the thing that tweaked me on my brain on this was that, wouldn't they have the 9 inches of rain in Houston a few years ago?
Yeah.
I don't think any of those people were on a flood. It had never happened before.
But parts of Houston are on a floodplain.
Right,
plane,
but I think,
you know.
Well, just to give everybody an example, I was digging through because I talked to Mr. Flanagan yesterday. The entire state of Indiana, there's only 18,000 policies. No, wait a minute, there's 19. And it's, the answer here. So we're trying to figure out who does what where here. And in the 19,000 is not kind of a lot. And there was a picture, it was at Channel 7 I was watching the other night, and this is the White River in some little town in Indiana. And the guy says, well, he's got his foot away from the water. And he goes, here's essentially the edge of the river right now. And he goes, you see that stop sign? There was a stop sign like a block and a half away. Well, you see the stop sign after that. There was one, you know, he could barely make it out. Maybe another three blocks down. He goes, across the street from that stop sign is where the river is supposed to be. And I'm thinking, I don't think the floodplain extended four blocks, but I don't know. But then when I talked to Nancy yesterday, I talked to John saying we should talk about this, I saw this 19,000 policies total in the state of Indiana. I'm like, oh, ouch. And just to give you an idea, and they have the years here. In 2025, there were 366 claims. This is in the whole state. 2024, 43. 2023, 13. 2022, 35. So, wow. Now, what, Nance, you go first. What do you suppose is going to happen here to all these people? They're basically shit out of luck or what?
Yes. I believe so. I looked it up. We're in Region 5, and it's private engineering and mapping firms that do it, along with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, along with the U.S. Geological Survey. and the state of Indiana does some of it. So they all form a coalition, I guess, and that's how they do it. But just because there's 19,000 policies doesn't mean people don't realize they're in a flood. People, under, you know, you're told if you're in a floodplain when you take title to the property. This is recorded.
This is on the listing. I've seen Audrey, you'll say flood insurance required, and there'll be a yes or no in that little spot.
Yes, it'll have it really. An X means you're not in the floodplain. Any other symbol means you could be being something else to the floodplain maps. It doesn't mean that they're not in. A lot of people choose if it's just land on their property, but it's not. You know, they choose, and it's far enough away from their house, they can ask for an exception and not pay for the floodplain insurance.
If you had a 200-foot backyard, 100 feet of it could be in the floodplain and the house part isn't.
Right. You may apply that it, you know, to not have to get flood insurance. So that's really up to the individual. And they may say, no, you don't need it. It just depends. But if you have a mortgage, then you must have, in your floodplain, you must have insurance unless you apply to get the exemption that you're far enough away for it.
And you get that from the government or State Farm?
The government. So people, when you're saying there's only 19,000 policies, that may be true, but that doesn't mean that's many that weren't offered.
Okay, so you're let's say where you are. I know you're in Tinley, but you're at Tinley Creek. Now I'm guessing, since I've been to your place many times, I didn't see a creek. So it's a ways from you. What if we get a foot of rain, all of a sudden the Tinley Creek finds you, and then what?
Okay, it happened in Tinley Park. Well, obviously since I've been alive and in mortgages, so in the past 20 years, 25 years. And situation happened in Tinley Park where they're not in a floodplain, and it was just a stream of like two houses where it went for blocks and blocks and blocks and blocks. The city got involved, and somehow they got them these people lost everything in their house plus their cars. So it was,
well, the
was
car, cars serious. Are separate, right? The cars usually get paid for pretty easily.
I do not know. I mean, because the cars got flooded in their garage. I have no idea about that, but I know that they were completely wiped out, and somehow the village of Tinley Park, they had to get structural engineers in there, and I don't know if you can hear the dogs barking. Sorry about that. They had to get structural engineers in there, and they redesigned the water retention ponds and made adjustments so it could not happen again. But it was like a 100-year flood. I mean, so the city got involved, and somehow these people got reimbursed, okay, rather than just totally.
So at least they got some money.
They got some relief. They got relief.
Okay.
You know, they were made whole in that situation, but they didn't even have access to the flood insurance. So I'm saying if you actually have access to it and then you decide not to take it, I've had people in Payless Park where they redesigned the some roads and things of that nature. And then so homes that weren't in a floodplain all of a sudden were in a floodplain, and they did not want to pay for flood insurance. So they paid off their mortgages.
Wow.
Just paid them off. And then you don't have to worry about it.
When you say, does it cover everything? What if you got, you know, a $10,000 pool table in your basement? Does it cover that too, or just a house? I mean,
how far down does it dig? I don't know, because I don't know anybody that's actually had it that used it.
Okay.
But I know in Tinley Park, those people were made whole. But other than that, I haven't had any experience, you know, firsthand experience of what happens in that situation.
What was the Florida
situation? Private insurance, I know, doesn't work. Sorry?
What is the Florida situation? Jen, didn't we talk about one day that they were getting like 40 cents on the buck or something, flood insurance? Oh, is that different? Is that hurt? I mean, I don't know. That's what I'm asking.
What if it's a state program or something?
Oh, the state program?
Yeah, but
I don't know. I'm just reading up on the National Flood Insurance Program, and you know, all of Chicago participates in it. So anybody in Chicago, anybody in Tinley Park too, because Tinley Park participates in it. You can get, you know, flood insurance
if you're in a floodplain,
and whether you're in a floodplain or not, as long as you're in a, you know, a municipality that has subscribed to this program, and that requires their ordinances to track with minimum standards for, you know, new construction and so on to avoid, you know, flood risks. So I could get it here in Chicago, any place in Chicago, and anybody in Tinley Park and other places too. But it's, you know, municipalities aren't required to.
Well, there's a big difference between the flood where your street stuff backs up into your basement and the Chicago River running into your house. There's two different kinds of floods, right?
Right, right. And you know, I don't in as far as filing a claim. I mean, if it were, you know, if because of bad sewer or storm sewer management in Chicago, I don't know, you know, if, how the feds would feel about paying a claim, but it doesn't sound like they would deny it.
No, nobody in our block, before everybody put the sewers in where it stopped the stuff coming in, nobody ever got paid by anybody unless you had.
No. I remember a year or two ago, the alderman's office here sent out an email, you know, because there had been, you know, a storm where there was lots of basement damage and furniture loss and, you know, construction that had to take place. And they were offering grants of, I think, like $500 to $1,000 if you could document what had happened. So you needed photos and estimates and everything else. But well, that clearly was not part of the national program at all.
Well, they've got 19,000 people covered here. So I'm going to say that how much of the state's been affected? 25%. So let's say 5,000. How many houses do you think are getting screwed? 100,000? 70? I mean, we're not even close, are we?
If you didn't have the insurance, or if your municipality didn't participate in the program, I think you're SOL on the program.
Ugh. Now, what happens to those people, Nance? I mean, they can't live there. I mean, I don't think. At least they're not far south, where if you're like Tennessee or something, you get a bunch of snakes and everything in your place. I don't think Indiana's that bad, but so what happens? You move out and you don't have the dough, and what do you do with the place? It's like my sister-in-law, her cousin in Florida, is still paying her mortgage on a high-rise building she can't move back into, and that was 4 years ago or 3 years ago.
Well, then what did she do? Is she still paying it?
Yeah.
Well, then that's your answer. I mean, people just have to do what they have to do.
Well, she's got enough equity. They haven't told her whether they're going to fix the place or tear it down yet.
That's a problem. Well, so it really is. It's a huge problem. And John is right. I'm digging deeper, and it says that you can buy insurance if you're not in a floodplain, which is not what I've been told over the years at all, but
from the government.
Yeah.
It says FEMA encourages it because flooding can occur outside mapped high risk areas. So here would be a good comparison. Illinois is in an earthquake fault. Okay. Now, to me, it's the most flat land I've ever seen in my life, but whatever, right? And they offer earthquake insurance. If you don't take it, you have no coverage. And
do I have a YouTube video for you?
Okay, so, and they all say, well, it's up to you. I mean, Illinois is it, you know, we are at risk for an earthquake, but not very high or anything like that. I bet you 2% of the people have earthquake insurance.
Very few to none. Well, you know, when you go by and see a house being built now, you'll see the cement block going up and maybe the brick on the outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
Those little metal things, they look like aluminum foil where they come out, they go down and they hook into the brick like maybe a couple of feet down or half a foot down. You ever see them build those things? Those are for earthquake.
No, I have not seen that.
Well, if you see somebody putting up a brick establishment, you're going to see they're going to tie the two stacks of bricks up with these metal things, and that gives you lateral stability for an earthquake. somewhere.
That I did not know.
Well, if you're not having trouble sleeping already, I'll send you this YouTube video regarding the New Madrid quake in 18.
That's fine.
And it was the worst quake ever in this country by far, and it was in Illinois or Missouri. Is it Missouri or Illinois, John? It's
great. Well, they all come together.
It's staggering and how, and because of the, I guess the nice thing about earthquakes in California is because of the mountainous terrain, you could have a 7-point earthquake, and 100 miles away you get shook a little bit, it's no big deal for you, but in the geologic structure here, the earthquake wasn't that much stronger. It was a high 7. But it was like a 6.5 in Boston. It just kept going, and Mississippi River went the wrong way. Totally redesigned where the Mississippi ended up going because it couldn't. There were these things bursting out of the ground, and it happened. What, it was over like a 3-month period, wasn't it, General? A lot of people left the area.
1811 to 1812. Yeah,
but people left the area. They go, it's never going to stop. It just kept happening. I mean, if that happens again, I mean. Let's just say the city, the building I'm in is toast.
Yeah.
The building I'm in is toast.
Well, it's a brick building. It has serious stress top to bottom, but it has zero side stress. There was an article in, it was in Chicago Magazine, and it was about this whole thing and how they talked about the different faults. There's a big fault right down the East River in New York.
No, good. In 2008, here in, it was in Illinois, down south, Wabash River Valley, but it woke me up. This is in April 2008, and I thought I was in The Exorcist or something. The whole bed was banging against the wall. Everything in the room, I had like a chest of drawers and stuff on legs, and that was like swaying right in front. I thought I was like having a vision or something, and I freaked out. And I turned on the radio, and finally, after a couple of minutes, somebody said, we're getting some reports of seismic activity. It's like, well, at least I know what it was. But people who lived on the first floors of buildings like mine didn't feel a thing. My friend downstairs didn't feel a thing. But mine, because it's 1920s vintage, masonry construction, it wiggles in a high wind.
Yeah.
It was wiggling that night. It was enough to wake me up.
I was actually down there. I was down there that night. I bought my truck. My parents had just passed, and we were cleaning the house out and stuff, so I used an excuse to go buy this old pickup truck down in Tucson, because I always want to drive back on 66. Well, I'd stopped for the night in southern Illinois at this, I think it was a Best Western or something. Nice place. And all of a sudden, about 2 in the morning, the thing starts shaking. And I go, what the hell? And I'm thinking, okay, it's either a tornado, in which case I'm not going to survive, or it's an earthquake that if I just hang here, it'll be all right. And it shook my bag off the dresser. It was shaking pretty darn good. And was it a 4.5 or something, Jen, or 4.8?
It was 5.2.
Okay.
On the moment magnitude scale, and I forget how deep it was, because that's key in how much you feel and how far away from the epicenter you feel it, so...
You imagine if you were at the top of like the Hancock or something?
Yeah.
Well, that thing is built to sway what, 9 feet?
Yeah.
So this kind of thing. Now, what does this do for the economy in Indiana? I mean, it's got to be pretty awful. Is it going to continue on to the Wabash River and Ohio River and cause problems there too, or what?
Well, that's how these floods work. I mean, it went all the way down to New Orleans.
Yeah. Well, some of the stuff you see happening, we don't need it as natural stuff because didn't Tyson Foods, because of a shortage of beefers, beef cows, they're closing their Quad Cities place?
Yeah, yeah.
2,500 people? And they're not moving them anywhere. They're just firing them all. What does 2,500 people do to the Quad Cities, for God's sake? It's got to be devastating. What do you say we have a quick break here so we kind of blew through it? S&P futures are only up 50 cents, and the NASDAQ futures up 66, so we're down quite a bit from when we came in. We'll give a brief one here. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
Hello, and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tomorrow, Matt Byrne on the board. Jim Lawler in studio. We have Nancy and Jen on the line. S&P futures now down one. No, S&P futures down one. NASDAQ futures up 47, so that's still up a little bit. Real quick, we'll do this. We have we're up pretty strong here this morning. You know, kind of we're not. Everything was up. Gold and everything, it's all coming back here a little bit. I'm not sure why. DAX down 32.1%. FTSE down 7. Call that flat. Kick around down 35.4. So mildly bearish over there, but very mild. Asia, we've got the Nikkei is up 506.7%. Hang Seng down 336. That's 1.3. Shanghai up 55, 1.4. So bullish over there. Bonds, and this is what you got to watch here. 4.71 now on the 10-year. And we've got the 30. This is going to be a Nancy question in a second. 30 years, 5.2, almost 5.3. So continues to inch up here. Not good. Not good if you're looking at markets and you're looking at government interest payments. Oil's up 28 cents, 82.68, so hanging above 80 bucks. Gold, 7 bucks, was up more earlier, 44.44. Almost stuck down 4,000 2 weeks ago. It's had a big rally. Silver up 49 cents, 65.60. Foreign exchange, Japan's the one we're watching, 159.26. Still not back at the 160. So the intervention is still holding for a bit, but we'll see about that. Euro's almost at 116 again, so dollar slips the lowest since early June as rate hike bets fade. British pound 136 again, almost back near where it was the high. Crypto 397, 63, 498. What do you got for a quick traffic weather sports Cubs?
Yeah. Good morning, everyone. It's currently 7:44 a.m. on August 17th, 2026. Weather for Chicago today, 69 degrees currently, mostly cloudy skies, with a chance of isolated showers in the area later today, high of 77. Tonight, clear skies and a low of 64. Yes, we saw the Cubs lose against Cardinals yesterday. 11-4 was the final score. White Sox, though, won against Tigers, 7-5. White Sox are 65-58 losses this season. Cubs are 72-53 this season. Tonight they face off. Sox will play Cubs at Wrigley Field at 7:05. Two more games are planned for the 18th and 19th. Look to the NFL preseason. On Saturday, Bears won against the Browns, 34-10. Bears will be back again on Saturday with the Bengals. That's all I got, Chief. Back to you.
A couple of sports things. Tommy John died. I don't know if we mentioned that earlier or not. Obviously, the first guy to have Tommy John surgery. Pitched for a long time. Won a bunch of gold gloves. I think he was one of, I can't think of the fourth person, John and Nance and Jim.
Is it the elbow surgery?
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Ulnar collateral ligament.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, they take a ligament from somewhere else and you, if you don't have one, they grab one from a cadaver. I don't know if he needs to be a pitcher. They wrap it around.
It's like a Lou Gehrig's disease or Tommy John surgery.
Yeah. But I can't think of the fourth person, so I shouldn't even outpeep this, but there were only four pitchers, I think, that pitched to both Roger Maris and Mark McGuire. And
wow.
And he was one of them. I think the Necro brothers were the two, and I think it might have been Nolan Ryan that pitched all those times. And by the way, Nancy, you weren't on earlier. You've been volunteered. To go with Audrey and John, and I'll drive you guys up there, but then I'm going to go for some coffee to do yoga in the middle of the alpaca pasture.
Oh my goodness!
That was a place that Audrey dragged me because she wanted to buy some alpaca stuff and see alpacas like 5 years ago, and it's the same place. I'm thinking I recognize. And there's these people ladies doing yoga out in the middle of the pasture with the little alpacas going up and saying, "What are you doing?" I could see you doing it out there with Aud. And take John with; he needs it.
Okay, sounds like a date.
Can you imagine John?
Did they do alpaca adoptions there?
I'm sure you could.
I can't bring him home. Why not?
The little they're inoffensive. They're cute.
Yeah. You know. Oh
yeah. You know what's odd about them is that we're not into the toilet humor or anything, but you know, in the pasture they all poop in one spot. They don't poop all over the place. They keep the rest of the pasture clean.
Better than a lot of people.
Yeah. Better than a lot of people. They're like, hey, we're eating this grass. We don't really poop it on it. So they poop all in one spot.
Bizarre. There's only two that have faced both Mark McGuire and Roger Maris.
Really?
Nolan Ryan is one. The other one is Don Sutton.
Really? There was somebody else. Roger Maris and might have been one of the other guys afterward, but it was both of the Necro brothers. They both pitched for like 20 years.
Yes, but I guess they wouldn't pitch long enough to see Mark McGuire. Probably did see Roger Maris, but the AI says there's only two, Don said.
Now, wait a minute. Who knows more about this, me or AI?
We're not going to go there.
We're not going to go there? All right. All right, so back on the...
listen to this. It says one in 148 households in Indiana carries NFIP flood insurance.
Wow.
Okay. 0.7%. 88 of 92 counties have elevated flood risk, but low insurance coverage. With 4,441 recorded flood events and a $1.7 billion in damage, many flood losses in this state are likely uninsured.
Wow.
And it says there's 19,325 claims over 45-plus years across 18,144 current policies. The average claim payout is $15,303.
Well, that's not very much.
No. No.
Is there a number on the policy or whatever you need? I mean, in other words,
there's a certain amount, isn't it? I think there's a maximum.
It doesn't really say. It just says that in 2025, there's been 366 claims for $17.5 million. The average payout was
$47,732. Great.
So, I mean, I don't know what's going on, but I lived in Kansas growing up for a little while, and what we're seeing, you know, what we have seen in the past couple of weeks in Chicago, that's what it was like in Kansas. We did not have fire drills. We had tornado drills.
Well,
and power would be out for hours on end, and you'd have to stand in the school basement, and the nuns would come by and whack your calves if you stood on one leg versus another. I mean, a fire drill was so much more easier. You got out of the building.
Did that make you stand? Did that make you stand steadier? A nice big ruler on your calf?
Yeah, you have to stand steady. If you leaned on one foot versus the other or one hip, they came by with these rulers with that gold thing in them, and they whap your calves like there was no tomorrow.
Well, that's why you're
straight.
That's why you're very moral and upright today.
Yeah, I guess so. But anyways, I mean, that's what this reminds me of. It's constant storming. You know, they went through periods of that there. If, you know, they predicted bad weather for storms, everybody's like, yeah, okay, what else is new today, right?
Well, you're younger. When John and I were in school, it was air raid.
Civil defense alerts.
You're kidding. I never heard of that.
Well, you know, you went, the St. John Fisher had the school, and you went to the interior wall. You went out in the hallway, and you sat next to the interior wall, your legs crossed, and the thing was you put your head between your legs and kissed your ass goodbye.
Yeah.
You're kidding. Are you guys kidding me?
No.
We used to have at least once a year.
Yeah.
Did you both go to the same Catholic school?
Didn't matter. They were all the same.
No, they're all the same.
That is just bizarre. I've never heard of that. But then again, I saw someone take their child to the phone booth, and the girl didn't know what to do. She was like, what is this?
God. Well, they used to have air raid shelter, or fallout shelter.
Yeah, well, our school auditorium was designated. It's first thing somebody came into the school building was fallout shelter logo. Well, yeah. You know, I wouldn't want to try to survive anything in the school hall, let alone fallout.
Well, there was, interesting, my history. If you went down State Street, the subway was a fallout shelter.
Yeah.
But every one of them had a number on it, Nance. And Jimmy,
are you guys kidding? This is crazy. No. Because you wouldn't have. I mean, I don't think that the school auditorium. And no offense, Jen, but I don't think that would even survive a hurricane.
Oh no!
I mean, come on.
No, this was for radiation.
Yeah.
For radiation. I mean, if they knew, you wouldn't be here if they knew.
No,
I mean, what are we talking about?
The fallout lasts what, 2 weeks, Jen, or something?
Yeah.
When I was a janitor for the Chicago Public Schools, I was, of course, key personnel, Nance. The first thing they did was give you this huge thing of keys, right? Well, one of the schools was a fallout shelter. For, God, John, what was the number? It was like 120 people or something. And there was this huge room downstairs, and I won't say the basement, the lower floor. It wasn't for 120, it was like 50. There were 50 cots. There were, it had to be 15 things of water, big buckets of water.
Yeah, provisions. Yeah.
There was a box with all the medical stuff in there, first aid kits. There had to be 90 gazillion wafers. You were supposed to eat wafers for 2 weeks or whatever. There was water, there were wafers, medical stuff, there were blankets, pillows, and cots. And anything else you sort of needed for whatever, for that length of time.
No TV sets, because there wasn't going to be any TV.
No, there wasn't going to be any TV, but you could live there. It's, you know, the thing of it is, though, Nance, is that the world was whether it was a good idea or not, I mean, Congress said, okay, we're going to have these fallout shelters. And guess what? They actually had them.
Yeah.
You know,
they were actually staffed with stuff.
Yeah. If there were 60 people, there were 60 cots, or actually probably pads on the floor, but you had, as opposed to, remember when 9/11 happened, which we all remember, and all of a sudden all this money was spent towards making sure that you could evacuate cities and where you could bring people and where you could, you know, at the end of a decade, I challenge you to find a nickel of where that money was other than people's pockets.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of a decade, the original stuff was, say Chicago got hit with that, you could take 50,000 people out of Chicago by all the different trains and run them down to Rantoul or someplace, a former army base that was set up to be able to handle 50,000 to 100,000 people for a month. That never happened, did it, John?
No.
Well, with the fallout shelters, if it said 100 people, there was stuff there for 100 people for, was it 2 weeks or 30 days, yeah? I think it was 30 days.
30 days, yeah.
You could live down there for 30 days. Well, but I mean, if the schools all had bathrooms, you know, yeah. if long as there was running water, you could have bathrooms, and they, most of them had showers. You know, so I mean, you actually could live there. I mean, in London, the subway was the big air raid shelter, right?
Yeah.
And we actually used
did it work?
Sure. All kinds of people in London were in the subway every night.
And they'd have concerts. Yeah. You know, they'd have orchestras playing, you know, these gigantic cavernous subway stations in London, you know. And people would stay there until they got the all clear. You know, it's been a whole evening down there. Yeah.
My aunt grew up in London. Now, they had a bomb shelter in the backyard, where she and her mother spent, well, it's not every night because it was cloudy or something. It wasn't an air raid, but she and her mother spent the whole time in the backyard bomb shelter, and her brother and father slept under the dining room table. Figuring they had a big old sturdy dining room table, figured if the plaster started falling down, a table to protect them. I don't know, they must have been far away from the subway or whatever, but all kinds of people went to the subway.
Yeah. Well, Chicago had, you know, blackouts. You have people with blackout curtains in their car.
Yeah. This wasn't that long ago, Nancy.
I mean, I know.
At least it doesn't seem like it was. All right, so we have these things that are happening. Did you guys see the plows plowing the hail in Denver yesterday?
No.
They had so much hail, they had to plow the streets. The hail was like 6 inches deep. Oh, I don't know why they had to plow it, so they just wait for it to melt, but they did.
What the heck is going on? That's what I mean. It's crazy.
Well, so now, what we have a lot of stuff. Matter of fact, I've talked to some clients tonight, but, you know, there's this two things that are sort of happening. One is, on the one hand, this is more in an investment world. Now, of course, the people that are going to have to put $100,000 in their house, they're not buying any stock next week, I don't think. But maybe they are. Who knows? But I doubt it. On the one hand, you've got this movement towards propping up, not movement. No administration, it's not just these guys, wants the market to take a tumble in August, September, October before an election. I mean, I get that. I mean, duh. And so we're going to continue to prop, you know, the market up. I mean, we put a bunch of money in to save the yen 2 weeks ago, which really meant save the market, because we gave Japanese essentially a bunch of money to turn around and buy our bombs with. Well, how long does that last? You've got this current that anybody who's been in the market for the last 25 years, no matter what it is, it's always saved. We've got a, you know, COVID, market goes up. We got a war, the market goes up. Nobody cares. We put money in and up it goes. There's an inflation, you know, backstab on the thing, but we tell people there isn't, and by the way, those people, we don't care about them anyway. So you got that going on one side. Then on the other side, you've got debt going to the moon. You've got no ability to tax anybody. Not that I want taxes going up. You know, we're talking $1.2 trillion, $1.3 trillion now is our interest load, and it's only going higher. You would think that someplace, somewhere, somebody's got to get this money. Now, I shudder. Don't let anybody think that I want taxes going higher, but I don't see how the hell you don't. You know, you might be able to get a little bit of traction on tariffs because people are too dumb to realize that the tariff is on them. But you're not going to get much on that. So you've got, you know, the big, beautiful bill where you lower taxes for essentially rich people. You're getting a groundswell, I think, from the younger people now saying that's not the direction we got to go. I think we got a lot of issues, Nancy. You're not the only one bringing up. John, talk, please.
Well, I'm worried about real estate as always.
Yeah.
I think you know, the commercial stuff is, you know, it doesn't get talked about very much, but I think it's kind of a bellwether for what's going to happen down the road eventually. And I just think a lot of these lenders are going to take such huge haircuts on all these properties that it's going to, you know.
John, how is that getting absorbed? And Jim and Nance, please pile on. We'll go a couple minutes over because we're a couple minutes late. What? How is that getting absorbed? How does, you know, 175, the guy losing, you know, $70 million, $100 million on the place or more, and all the ones that you talk about, you and I talk about sometimes when we talk, the stuff you see in Crane, Chicago, but how is that being absorbed without a bump? I mean, no, nobody seems to be, no banks going under, no, you know, venture capital firms going under. How is it all that quiet? It's a lot of money.
Well, I think enough of it is spread around among lenders. And, you know, although this to me, it defies, you know, gravity in a way. At some point, all this stuff has to have some kind of change in behavior, because the money is just evaporating. You happen to write it off. And this isn't getting, you know, it's not encouraging for construction. But, you know, this is what I don't get, is that you look all over the West Loop and there's construction cranes everywhere. So I don't understand how, in a climate like this, people are still building and apparently filling up these places with high-flying borrowers. But I don't know where the money's coming from to fund the construction. I don't get it.
Well, yeah, I don't either. I mean, but we've had...
I don't know where the borrowers are coming from.
But, Nance, you got a minute. Tell us about what are these high interest rates on the Treasuries doing to mortgages and doing to your business?
Well, it's not, I mean, it's pretty dead right now, but it's August, so, you know, it's August, so you really can't tell. I mean, you'll know more once we get into September, October, where we're going. Is it going to be quiet the whole rest of the year? Stuff like that. It's hard. It's just very difficult to say what's happening. But the rates, I'm trying to look now. What are the mortgage rates for today?
Well, we've got a lot of cash buyers that you and Audrey deal with. But when you actually start talking about today's prices, if the interest rates are 7.5, that's a big nut.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is. I mean, back in our day, that would have been nothing, but...
yeah, the prices weren't here, though, in our day.
Right.
Yeah. The average...
Where are you now on your 30-year? Are you over 6?
Oh, my God, yeah, we've been over 6 for a long time. Everybody has been. Everybody
six,
has been.
6.5?
6.71.
Really? Yeah. Why didn't I not think it was that high? That's why I have.
Oh, it's been that high. It's been that high. Investment property is 7.75.
That's a lot.
Just on an average, yeah. I mean, it's like 1% higher. It's way. I mean, but people are buying. There is buying activity going on.
I don't see Aud having the demand from her group of guys that like to buy and remodel. It seems like those guys are pretty quiet lately.
Well, sure. I mean, the investment properties are getting, well, if you're going to pay 1% more, can you imagine? They're just getting hit more, that's all.
Well, plus I think the cost to redo stuff, I mean, the plasterboard and the nails and everything, it keeps going up.
Up, 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 yeah, yeah. Up, 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 everything's gone up.
Well, guys, we got a dash, good discussion.
It was a good discussion. I had no idea you guys had air raids. That's really crazy.
You guys going out and buy your new yoga mats for the pasture?
I'm waiting to see John actually arrive in the car, and then I'll have Amazon deliver it to the llama farm.
Now, I'm going to work on converting the garage to a alpaca pen or something.
they're cute little guys.
Well, John has to actually get out here, and then we'll know. That yes. John exists. Right now, John has a name. I mean, it's better than no name, but John has a name. Nobody, just
the
voice.
I'll bring some crutches so I can get up after the yoga session. You know.
He's the new Surrey.
You know, if we did a podcast, we'd put a cardboard cutout of him up there. I mean, if we had to be on... And
just as good as the original. You know?
God. SP Futures now down $1. It was up like 15 when we came in. NASDAQ futures up 67. It was 167, so we're being a little shrinkage. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex, offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.
So you gonna get another job?
I don't think I'd like another job.
What are you gonna do about money and bills and...
You know, I've never really liked paying bills. I don't think I'm gonna do that either.